Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Bob Oakes, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Georgia Senator and lifelong Democrat Zell Miller says he's backing George W. Bush for president. In his new book, A National Party No More, The Conscience of a Conservative Democrat, Zell Miller warns the Democratic Party that it can't treat the South as if it's gone with the wind and hope to win. Tonight, On Point, Zell Miller, the Democratic Party, and the white Southern vote. But we begin this hour not in the South, rather on the West Coast, in Sacramento today, where Arnold Schwarzenegger gave his inaugural address to more than 7,000 invited guests, including celebrities and past California governors. Governor Schwarzenegger struck an optimistic chord in his inaugural address.
I ask all of you to join me in a new partnership for California, one that is civil and respectful of our diverse population, one that challenges each and every one of us to serve our state in a joyful, productive, and creative way. Ladies and gentlemen, I have an immigrant's optimism.
Joining us now is Tim Grieve, who covered the Schwarzenegger inauguration for Salon.com. Hi, Tim.
Hey, Bob. How are you?
Fine, thanks. Describe the scene at Arnold Schwarzenegger's inauguration today.
Well, it was actually a fairly subdued event, given how these things can go. I covered a rally for Schwarzenegger the weekend before the election at the very same location at the state capitol. There was much more excitement, much more tension with protesters and supporters, and a lot more people generally. Today it was a bit of a quieter event. The protests were muted, and Schwarzenegger tried very hard, as the clip you just played suggested, to try to bring people together and say it's time to put the rancor of the past behind us and move on.
More about the inaugural address, if you would. The Schwarzenegger campaign was fairly devoid of specifics. Was the speech the same, or was it inspiring to those who heard it?
Well, there were a few more specifics in terms of you know what he exactly intends to do in the next few days. He repealed a very unpopular car tax today. He called for special sessions of the state legislature to deal with the state's budget crisis and workers' compensation issues. He promised to repeal a very controversial measure to provide driver's licenses to illegal immigrants. It still was very short on details of, for instance, how he would pay to make up for the vehicle license fee cut that he repealed today.
Which is worth, as I understand it, about $4 billion to the California Treasury?
That's right, and that's to a state that's already facing a $10 billion budget deficit. So he has, his first act is to essentially add another $4 billion to an existing budget deficit, and there will be a discussion at a later day about how we'll pay for all of that.
How quickly is Schwarzenegger expected to address California's massive budget problem?
He's going to have to address it very quickly. Within the next few weeks, he will have to submit his budget proposal for the coming budget year. And also, there will be a special election of session of the state legislature in which they will deal with those issues.
On inauguration day, there's of course much pomp. There are smiling faces, plenty of goodwill for fixing the huge problems of the day. Not the least of which is the budget crisis in California, which makes me wonder: how long do you think in California does the honeymoon, the good cheer, last?
Well, you know, Democrats are talking a good game today about embracing this spirit of cooperation, but at the same time, they're very serious that if he wants to have a debate about cutting the budget, and if it involves cutting social services or rolling over debt into future years and for future generations, they're going to stand up against it. So, you know, that fight will be engaged within a matter of weeks.
So the headbutting with the rest of California's political establishment begins soon.
That's right. It will begin almost instantaneously.
A political aside, I read with some admitted amusement that Governor Schwarzenegger's speech was drafted in part by a Democratic political consultant, Bob Shrum, who's, of course, very close to Senator Edward Kennedy, Schwarzenegger's uncle-in-law, so to speak. It seems to prove that blood is truly thicker than party politics.
Well, that's right. And Schwarzenegger has done a lot of things over the last few weeks that would suggest that party politics aren't going to be the most important thing to him. He has appointed to lead the California Environmental Protection Agency a very staunch environmental advocate, the kind of guy who would traditionally give Republican governors fits. At the same time, though, he's appointed as the number two and number three positions in that department, a timber company lobbyist and a lawyer who worked to fight environmental laws for big corporations. So there's a lot of tension there, but there's also a lot of signs that he's reaching across the aisle.
Well, which gives rise to the notion that Governor Schwarzenegger, is not necessarily a novice when it comes to politics. These moves could prove to be quite shrewd.
No, they could be, and everyone on both sides, from the far right to the far left, I think is really, really holding breath right now, trying to see which way this is going to play out, because no one really knows whether these appointments are, window dressing for what will turn out to be a more conservative George W. Bush style agenda, or whether they're really an effort to change the way things are done in Sacramento, as Schwarzenegger says that they are.
Tim Grieve, one more question. The aforementioned Bob Shrum, the speechwriter, the Democratic consultant, is also a very active in John Kerry's presidential campaign, Senator John Kerry's campaign, which brings to mind this question. With Governor Schwarzenegger in the corner office in California, what's the 2004 buzz like right now? Do Republicans believe that Arnold can help George Bush win in California in 2004, which is, of course, usually the Democrats' prize?
That's right. That's certainly their hope. And what you'll hear again and again is it's always better to have a governor from your state there to help with the reelection campaign than there isn't, than the alternative. On the other hand, Gray Davis was a very good whipping boy for George W. Bush, and it would have been very easy for him to run in California on a platform that you have these terrible problems here because you have a terrible Democrat for a governor, and don't blame me. A year from now, he won't be able to say that with one of his own in the state house here in California.
Tim Grieve, thank you.
My pleasure.
Tim Grieve covers politics for Salon.com. He spoke with us from Sacramento. National Democratic leaders are as nervous as a long-tailed cat round a rocking chair when they travel south. So says Georgia Senator Zell Miller in his new book, A National Party No More. He has no use for those he calls the Naive Nine, the Democratic presidential candidates who he compares to streetwalkers in skimpy halters and hot pants plying their age-old trade for the fat wallets on K Street. When Howard Dean awkwardly said he's the candidate for guys with Confederate flags, Zell Miller felt that he had proved his point. Is Zell Miller right? Is the Democratic Party no longer a national party? Has the Democratic Party lost touch with Dixie? Can any of the Democratic presidential candidates win back the South? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from Washington, D.C. is Zell Miller, who became senator of Georgia in 2000. Before that, he served two terms as California's governor. Good evening and welcome, Zell Miller.
Georgia's governor.
Oh, I'm sorry. Georgia's governor.
You've left California now. We're now talking about the South.
I just have Arnold in my head tonight.
I know it.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, a senior editor at Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hi, Jack.
Hello, Bob, and hello to Senator.
Hey, how are you?
Just fine, thanks.
Zell Miller, let me start where we left off in California. Do you think that I know we're going to talk about the South here and spend the hour talking predominantly about the South, but do you think that California's that Arnold Schwarzenegger's election as California's governor gives the Republicans new hope for winning California in the 2004 elections? And what's it say overall about politics in California?
Well, honestly, I have no idea because I don't know very much about California. I guess I could start talking and maybe make something up, but frankly, I don't know that much about California.
All right, then let's go to the South. Make the case. Why and how is the Democratic Party out of step with the rest of the nation in the South?
Well, first of all, the title of my book is A National Party No More. National means nationwide. It means nationwide. And when you write off one-third of the country, the fastest-growing region at that, and have for the last several election cycles, then you're not a national party. You're not nationwide. Another example is that none of the so-called national Democratic leaders can come south and campaign for a fellow Democrat without doing more harm than good.
Why is that?
Well, because they're considered far too liberal. They're out of the mainstream. I mean, Tom Daschle can't come south and help a Max Cleland when he's running. Nancy Pelosi is not going to be able to come south and help Democrat candidates running in the South. And, of course, Terry McAuliffe can't come. And, in fact, Bill Clinton and Al Gore, even though they are Southerners by birth, they can't come because they're considered too liberal, and they end up doing more harm than good. I mean, don't take my word for it. Just look back on the last few years and see if any of them have come and helped anybody.
You said that you don't trust any of the Democrats running for
president. No, I haven't said I don't trust any of the Democrats, and I haven't said that I don't have any use for them, a term you used a while ago. They're all good and decent and honorable people, very smart, probably smarter than I am. Certainly smarter than I am. What I said was, in the book, and the point that I make, is that they have adopted the wrong features to be running on to do very well in the South. To varying degrees, they all want to increase your taxes, and they all want to get out of Iraq just as soon as we possibly can. And these are This is the worst feature of the McGovern campaign of 72, peace at any cost, and it's the worst feature of a Mondale campaign, I'm going to raise your taxes, of 1984. What they should have done is looked at how Bill Clinton won in 92 and 96, or even better, how John Kennedy won in 60. In 1960, John Kennedy carried the state of Georgia by a larger percentage than he carried his home state of Massachusetts. In fact, I think we gave him the second largest percentage in the country next to Rhode Island. How did he do that? He did that by talking about cutting taxes. He did that by standing, in the Kennedy-Nixon debates, he was the one who came across the strongest on national defense. And then when he was president, he governed that way by standing up to the Russians. And he could have been reelected had he not been assassinated.
When you call the Democratic presidential candidates the naive nine, what do you mean?
Well, I mean, I haven't looked up naive in the dictionary, but I think it means without a clue. And I think Howard Dean's Southern strategy, which he announced a couple of weeks ago, shows that they are without a clue about how you campaign in the South.
Howard Dean, you've called Howard Dean shallow. Is that correct?
I said that he is, by the way, I don't want to beat up on Howard Dean so much because I have already said a lot of things, and we'll be glad to talk with you more about him because he's a neighbor of you there. But I want to say a good thing about Howard Dean. We were lieutenant governors together. We were governors together for 8 years. And I want to say this. Howard Dean has shown all of the political folks how you go about raising money in an honorable and honest way and not really going after the big money from the special interest. And I commend him for that.
Howard Dean has, following up on something you talked about just a second ago, probably did stub his toe when he made that crack about wanting to win the votes of Southerners who display Confederate flags in their automobile windows. Was that message wrong for Democrats in that his idea to appeal to all Southern Democrats, conservatives and liberals, is at the heart of that message?
Well, it was an insult because what he was doing is he was taking the old stereotype, the old caricature of the South, and just perpetuating it and saying to everybody, this is what I think the South is. The South is not that way at all. The South is like the rest of the country, frankly. The modern South today, it's not the old racial South of the past. There are 5,500 African Americans elected in public offices scattered throughout the South, 5,500. They are elected statewide in states like Georgia, where that are 70% white. If you take the economy of the South, it's much larger than the economy of New England. If you take the economy of the South, it's the third largest economy in the world, behind the United States as a whole and Japan. A few weeks ago, or been a couple of months ago, I guess now, Newsweek magazine had their dream high schools listed, their 100 dream high schools listed. 7 of the top 10 were in the South. 22 out of the top 50 were in the South.
Senator Zell Miller, hang on. We want to continue the conversation. I'm Bob Oakes, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Bob Oakes, sitting in tonight for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the Democratic Party's weakening base in the South. Southerners, do you agree with Senator Zell Miller that Democrats have alienated you? Is he right? Is the Democratic Party no longer a national party? Do you agree with Zell Miller's assessment that the Democratic candidates are the naive nine? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking, of course, with Zell Miller, who became Senator of Georgia in 2000. Before that, he served two terms as Georgia's governor. Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at Atlantic Monthly magazine. Senator, just so we can continue or perhaps cap off what we were talking about in relation to Howard Dean, what is it that Howard Dean doesn't get, in your opinion?
Are you talking about the South or about the nation?
About the South.
Well, the same thing that he does not get about the nation. See, Howard Dean right now is not really running for president. He is running to get the Democratic nomination. And in order to get the Democratic nomination, you have to pander as far as you possibly can to the left, because that's where the votes are as far as Iowa is concerned. If you want an example of that, 4 years ago, there were 61,000 people who voted in the Iowa caucuses. 61,000. Now, keep that figure in mind. In Iowa, there are 32,000 unionized teachers. There are 28,000 public employees who are unionized. Add that up and see who votes in that Iowa caucus. It's the very far left. It's the ones who belong to these more extreme, more to the left special interest groups. They're going to be the ones who carry the day in Iowa, and Iowa is going to be the tail that wags the Democratic dog. Whoever comes out of Iowa, whether it's Dean or whether it's Gephardt or whoever it is, and heads to New Hampshire, is already going to have a big leg up, and they're going to be hard to stop. And That's just not representative of the Democratic Party. That's not how you really get elected. Now, later when he comes back and tries to put this, he starts then moving to the center and moving to the right, it's going to be very, very difficult for him to do that, because he has gone so far to the left with his position on the war and so far to the left with his position on doing a tax increase.
So, just sort of explain it in your view, then, by pandering, so to speak, to teachers and other unions to the left in order to get through the primaries, to be successful in the primaries, the Democratic presidential candidates risk the election.
That's exactly right. And that's what's happening right now. That's not how Bill Clinton got elected in 92 and in 96. That's not how John Kennedy got elected back in '60, or Jimmy Carter in '76. Look at the ones who have been successful. He is running his campaign very similar to the way that Mondale and McGovern ran theirs, and Dukakis to a certain extent, but especially Mondale and McGovern, and that is, they have steered so far to the left that it's going to be very difficult for them to come back and get and right the boat and get it headed in the right direction after these early primaries are over. I think you're going to have a Democratic nominee very early. I don't know who it'll be. It looks like it may very well be Howard Dean, but you're going to have a Democratic nominee very early in 2004. I guess they think that they'll have a lot of time to be to try to get back to the center, but it's going to be so difficult because they've painted themselves so far over into that left corner.
On Points News analyst is Jack Beatty. Jack, weigh in here.
Well, you know, last night I watched Dick Gephardt talk to a group of Iowans in Waukee, Iowa. And Senator Miller, I mean, I know exactly what you're saying. And, of course, you're right that the interest groups in primaries rule. Certainly they do in the Republican Party, as we both know. But what struck me looking at these
There's
folks
a difference in, there, though, and let's talk about that in a little while. Go ahead.
Okay. But what struck me looking at these people in Waukee, Iowa, was, they just didn't look like leftists. I mean, for one thing, they were farmers and working people and, you know, and older folks who wanted their Social Security and their Medicare. And their questions were informed. I they certainly knew what was happening in the world, but they didn't quite answer to this this picture of leftists. They were just kind of good Midwestern folks who were worried about jobs, for example, and were very interested in hearing what Mr. Gephardt had to say about trade agreements that let our jobs go away. And I know that, you know, just since NAFTA, 700,000 textile jobs have gone, a lot of them in the South. And it struck me, listening to Gephardt, that a lot of Southern heads would nod when he said, you know, we have to have fair trade. We can't just lose our job base to these other countries without getting fair trade. So I guess I'm just having a hard time going from that picture I saw in the library of Waukee, Iowa, to what you just said about these Iowan voters.
They're the salt of the earth, aren't they? And I believe that, and I know what you're saying is correct, and you're right. He would have some nodding of heads in the South when he starts talking about losing those textile jobs.
But what you're saying is that the message still won't be enough to begin to move Southern voters toward him, enough Southern voters to make a difference.
I don't think it's just Southern voters. The title of my book is A National Party No More, The Conscience of a Conservative Democrat. That's one thing, and I talked about why it's not a nationwide party. And now we have shifted, and we're talking about 2004 elections and the strategy that you're using, or not that you're using, but that these candidates are using. And that's kind of two different things to a certain extent. But what was your question then?
My question was, following off of Jack's comment, even though Richard Gephardt gets a lot of nodding heads when he talks about trade policy, nodding heads on the part of hardworking people in the Midwest, in the South, or across America, in your view, is not going to be enough to bring middle-of-the-road Democrats to the Democratic Party in numbers great enough to make a difference in this election.
Well, not when you're saying at the same time that you're going to raise people's taxes by $1 trillion. And that's what Gephardt is saying. I like Gephardt. He's a good man. I can remember when he ran in 88 and came to Georgia, and I went to some of his rallies. But you can't run for president saying that you're going to increase the taxes on the people by $1 trillion. And in effect, that is what Gephardt has said.
Okay, let's go to the phones and hear some of the views of some of our On Point listeners. 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Jason is calling from Greenville, North Carolina. Hi, Jason. Go ahead.
Hey, how you doing? I was pretty much just agreeing with Mr. Miller. I mean, I'm a Southerner. I'm 22. I work. Most people I work with and people I know and stuff like that, they don't think the Democratic Party's too left. It's just they're tired of the way things are going, especially with, I guess, with the way the administration is going right now, jobs leaving, especially textile jobs. I mean, they're leaving out of the state like crazy. And it's hard to get a job or anything like that. And, I live right beside the military base, and, you know, people kind of get weird about the war and stuff. So I don't think Democrats are, you know, too far to left or not hitting on point. I kind of think they're hitting on point. I don't think, I guess it's more like I guess maybe like big media or whatever kind of plays it down, but I really think that I think Democrats are right on point.
Senator Miller, how about that?
Well, I like the Democrats of North Carolina like I like the Democrats of Georgia and the South and everywhere. In fact, this book was written to try to help the Democrats, to try to throw them a life preserver, to try to tell them how you survive in a presidential election. Everything that the young man has said is true. I do think the economy is going to improve, and I think the jobs are going to be coming back. But the fact of the matter is, how many times has North Carolina voted for a Democratic nominee for president in the last 10 years, in the last 10 election cycles? You want me to tell you?
Go ahead.
Once.
And when was that?
That was when Jimmy Carter ran in 1976. They may have, I can't remember, they may have carried it one other time, but certainly in 8 out of the last 10 elections, North Carolina has voted for the Republican candidate for president.
So your view is that...
So, I mean, it might be good to take just for a second to look at this. Let's look at the last 10 elections since that John Kennedy election in 1960. The Democrats have lost every southern state 4 times. They have lost every southern state except one twice. 3 times they have been able to carry 3 or 4 states. When they did that, they won. When they didn't do that, they lost. That's the point I'm trying to make.
Jack Beatty?
Well, you know, when I think of that, the difference between President Kennedy's election and today, I come to a moment in 1965 when Lyndon Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act, and he looked downcast. And Bill Moyers, his assistant, said, what's the matter, Mr. President? You just signed this historic piece of legislation. And by the way, it passed with Republican votes. He said, I've just signed away the South for the Democratic Party for our lifetime. And I guess I'm just curious about that. Is there a cause and effect there, Senator Miller, between the Democrats' problems in the South and the Democrats and the identification of black voters with the Democratic Party? I'm not saying racism or anything like that. I'm just saying, was Johnson right?
Well, certainly it looks like that after the first few elections after he signed it. But I don't think you can make that argument at all now. I think it comes back to 2 main things. It doesn't come back to race. It comes back to the protection of a person's pocketbook, letting them keep some of that hard-earned money, like that 22-year-old young man that called in a while ago is earning. Let them keep more of their own money instead of sending it to the government. You work 4 months out of a year right now just to pay taxes to the government. To keep some of their money, that's a big issue with them. And the other thing is protecting the country. The South is a very, very patriotic region. There are a lot of military bases there, but it goes further back than even that, before those military bases were there. Always, in every war, predominantly the largest percentage of people who fight in those wars come from the South. It's a very patriotic region. Mm-hmm. So it's not race. It may have been in the 60s after that, and it may have even been to a certain degree in the 70s. But that's not what defeated McGovern in the South in 72 so bad. And where he couldn't get but about 28% of the vote in Georgia, for example, while Sam Nunn was beating a Republican for the U.S. Senate seat, it had to do with his position on the war. And unfortunately, that's the same sort of position that Howard Dean has chosen.
Getting out at any cost? Is that your take on what Howard Dean says?
Pretty much so. He would never have gone in to begin with. And I think most Southerners and most people that really give it some thought understand that if you don't, I mean, John McCain is not a Southerner. He's from Arizona. He said that Iraq is the central battlefield when it comes to fighting terrorism. Tom Friedman, the great Pulitzer Prize winning columnist for the New York Times, he has said Iraq, quote, is the whole ball game, end quote. That's what I'm talking about.
You know, I can't let this go, though, without asking you that many Republicans and Democrats say they believe they were misled by the Bush administration, believe they were lied to about the justification for going to war with Iraq, whether there were weapons of mass destruction or not, whether Iraq was an imminent threat to the U.S., whether the administration has properly calculated the operating theater in post-war, post-formal war Iraq. Did we place too much trust in the administration in regard to these issues. And I know that you travel throughout the South, and I know that you're hearing some of these same questions and some of these same frustrations with this war.
Well, first of all, if President Bush was lying, then President Bill Clinton was lying in 1998 when he said that Saddam Hussein must not be allowed to use nuclear weapons on his neighbors. He used the term nuclear weapons. He also talked about poisonous gas and biological weapons. Al Gore used the very same language about using Saddam, not letting Saddam Hussein use nuclear weapons. And he added to it, and we know he added to it, we know that he would use weapons of mass destruction because he's used them on his own people. Now, I don't think Bill Clinton was lying, and I don't think Al Gore was lying, and I don't think President Bush was lying. I think they were all telling the truth. And I think that before many more months are over, we're going to see from the work that David Kaye is doing over there, still searching these things out, that's going to be true. But it still comes back. Don't take my word for it. I mean, perhaps I'm prejudiced. I'm biased. Look at what John McCain said. I mean, John McCain said, and look at what Tom Friedman said about the importance of Iraq in today's world. I mean, this is our best chance. This is the best chance we've ever had in history to change the course in the Middle East. And isn't that what we've all wanted now for a half a century?
Let me ask you this question, though, Senator. With the headlines, with the daily headlines, sometimes the hourly headlines about the new U.S. casualties in Iraq, the mounting numbers of dead and wounded, many Americans are greatly concerned. And you mentioned earlier that some of the Democrats are at risk of being painted with the label "peace at any cost" in Iraq, which of course sunk George McGovern in his campaign against Richard Nixon when they were talking about Vietnam. And many Democrats and some Republicans are worrying that the Bush administration may now be engaging in a move to turn Iraq over to Iraqis before they're ready for it, just so that the U.S. can get out before George Bush goes to or can reduce our presence there, if not fully get out, before George Bush goes to New York for the Republican National Convention and then goes on to the election in November 2004. Might not he be painted with that same label, peace at any cost?
Oh, I think you're taking the partisan line there that some of them are putting out. Look, let's make it very clear about these deaths. Every single soldier matters. Let there be no mistake about that. But the only way to measure our degree of safety is the absence of attacks. And we will eventually be hit again in this country because no anti-terrorist effort can ever be 100% effective. And there are countries who want us to fail because they don't like this return of American ideals and our stand for freedom. And we're in a contest right now of wills more than weapons. They want to drain our will. And as William Sapphire says, dishearten us. I saw a news broadcast, I'm trying to remember when it was, it's been about a week ago on NBC Evening News, where they were at Ward 57 at the Walter Reed Hospital, where all of the returning soldiers who have had amputated limbs are, and they were being fitted for their new limbs. And they asked those young soldiers, did they support the war? And to a person, they all said that they did, and there's about a dozen of them or more.
On Point listeners, join the conversation with Georgia Senator Zell Miller after the break. I'm Bob Oak, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is Bob Oaks. I'm sitting in for Tom Ashbrook this evening, On Point. We're talking with Georgia Senator Zell Miller about the Democratic Party and its struggle to reach voters across the nation, but especially struggles to reach voters in the South. Are Democrats caught in deep long-term trouble across the nation and in the South? What's the GOP doing right now? How can a Democratic presidential candidate win in the South? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking with Zell Miller, who became Senator of Georgia in 2002. Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. And on the line with us right now from Hartwell, Georgia, is James Cobb, professor of history of the American South at the University of Georgia. His upcoming book is titled Old South, New South, No South, A History of Southern Identity. Professor Cobb, hi.
How are you doing?
Let's ask you your take on Zell Miller's view that the nation and the South is lost to the Democrats in 2004 before the whistle even starts blowing on the campaign kettle.
Well, I think Senator Miller may be right. And as a fellow Georgian and a lifelong Democrat, it pains me. To say that, I'm not sure. As a professor, I'm obligated to complicate matters a little bit. I'm not sure that I quite agree with Senator Miller's interpretation of why this is the case. Because I think the problem for the Democrats in the South is that if they are to meet Senator Miller's definition of being a national party, they're going to actually have to become too much of a regional party as far as the South is concerned, particularly white Southerners. And I think that's going to be very difficult. I don't know anything about California or very much about other regions per se in the country, but I do know a little bit about the South, and I think that the idea of even making a regional appeal anymore is very challenging because the South has changed so much, not simply because of the changes related to the civil rights movement, but in migration from other regions has really changed the face of the electorate, particularly here in Georgia. And although these in-migrants, a lot of them turn out to be quite conservative, they're not as conservative, usually speaking, as white Southerners are on issues like abortion or gun control. The economy is changing. You have North Carolina, where we're talking about losing textile jobs and thinking in terms of more protection. And then we've got other parts, the South Carolina, Piedmont, or Alabama, where in both states where they're also losing textile jobs, but they have this tremendous influx of foreign direct investment. So the South is a much more complicated place, and making a regional appeal is going to be difficult on those grounds. And I'm afraid I have to respectfully disagree with Senator Miller on the question of race, because I do think that race is a very, very significant issue still. I think that...
How so, Professor Cobb?
Well, I think if you... Senator Miller's right about John F. Kennedy in 1960, but in addition to the things he talked about, one of the things he didn't talk very much about was race. And he made a last-second phone call to Coretta Scott King when Dr. Martin Luther King was incarcerated in the Georgia State Pen as a symbolic gesture. But even then, Atlanta's black precincts went for Nixon in 1960, and I think if Kennedy had survived with having sent troops to Oxford and Birmingham, and then if the Civil Rights Act had passed, presuming that he lived, he would have been wearing that collar as well. So you have, we know what happened. Kennedy got, for example, in South Georgia, he got 77% of the vote in 1960, but Barry Goldwater in the very same county has got 62% of the vote the following election, and he did that by employing what became the Republican Southern strategy. And I'm afraid this strategy is still with us. You can look at Mississippi, may well have more elected black elected officials than any state in the South, and yet if you look at the recent gubernatorial campaign there with Haley Barbour, you see the subtle and not so subtle use of the race issue running throughout that campaign.
Now, Professor Cobb, I'm wondering, 44 years after Kennedy in 2004, what can Democrats do?
Well, I don't know, and I don't, you know, frankly, I'm not so sure they should worry about it, because if you look at those statistics about the times that Democrats won the South, I'm not so sure about Jimmy Carter, but I am sure that Bill Clinton could have been elected president without winning a single Southern state. And I know the times when the Republicans have swept the South, that their victory was so national that they didn't need the Southern votes either.
Just so I'm clear on this, you're saying then bypass the South and concentrate elsewhere for the
Democrats? Well, I'm saying that it becomes a sort of damned if you do, damned if you don't situation for the Democrats. If they are willing, how far to the right can they go and still count on the very dependable, 90% base that they typically get from African American voters in the South, in order to take a stab at courting more conservative white Southern voters who are not going to, what are the Democrats going to say to them that the Republicans, aren't going to say and be more appealing in doing so? Particularly, we can't presume that the Republicans are going to sit still and let the Democrats move to the right without moving to the right themselves. And in fact, it would seem to me that it would be the possibility if a greater Democratic effort to more conservative white voters in the South might have the effect of moving the Republicans further to the right and costing them some other state. But I'm convinced enough about the state of Democratic prospects in the South as Senator Miller is to lie. I wonder whether it's a very sensible expenditure of time in presidential elections for them to be trying to go after white voters who in the South. I mean, no Democratic presidential candidate since 1964 has gotten even close to a majority of the white vote.
Okay, Professor Cobb, hang on. Senator Miller, can Democrats write off most of the South? Can Democrats write off white voters in the South in this campaign, afford to?
Well, first of all, it's good to hear from Dr. Cobb. He's one of the smartest people I know, and he certainly knows a great deal about the South. Somehow we got into this. I thought we were going to talk about my book. Somehow we got into a discussion about whether or not they're going to be able to carry the South this time or not. That was not the thrust of my book at all. The thrust of my book is that this is not a nationwide party anymore because you have not been able to carry the South all of these years. And I agree certainly with Dr. Cobb. You've got to treat it pretty much like the rest of the nation. But you have got to, whenever I start talking about tax cuts and things like that, somebody always comes back, I thought you would tonight, and say, well, that's just Republican light. That's just Bush light. Well, that's not what it is at all. It's where the people are. It's where they were in 2000. It's where they were in 1992 and 96, and it's where they are going to be in 2004. And I do disagree with Dr. Cobb to a certain extent on the race issue. I mean, in Georgia last year, while we had Max Cleland and our Governor Roy Barnes being defeated by 46 or 47% they were getting, we had an African-American attorney general. We had an African-American commissioner of labor who were winning by 56 or 57%.
Senator, let me ask you, we do only have a couple of minutes left, and I do want to ask you a quick question, if I might. Given your strong support of President Bush, the fact that you did vote with the White House on so many issues, why is it on your way? Why is it that you never announced a party switch and became a Republican?
Because I'm not a Republican, and I'm not going to become a Republican. I'm a Democrat. I'm a Georgia Democrat. I have been elected as a Democrat 7 different times in Georgia in statewide races. I'm trying to help my party. I want to tell them how to survive. And this is not the way that they're going to be able to survive. And I'm not talking about the presidency. I'm talking about electing U.S. senators. I'm talking about electing U.S. congressmen. I'm talking about electing governors in the South. Right now, if you run for statewide office in North Carolina or Georgia or anywhere else as a Democrat, you start off with 2 strikes against you because the National Party has pulled its national leaders so far to the left that they're out of the mainstream. I'm really sorry that we got so much into the presidential race because that's not what my book is about at all. My book is about that they have let this 1/3 of the country go. As I said in one of my book openings In one of the chapters, I said there was a time when the leading Democrat looked south and said, I see one-third of the nation ill-housed, ill-clothed, ill-fed. Now national Democratic leaders look to the south and say, I see one-third of the nation, and it can go to hell. That's what bothers me.
Senator Zell Miller, thank you very much for speaking with us tonight. We appreciate it.
Sure.
Senator Zell Miller, Senator of Georgia, his book is titled A National Party No More, The Conscience of a Conservative Democrat. Now back to our news analyst, Jack Beatty. Jack, let me ask a question of you that was asked tonight just a few minutes ago. Should Democrats write off the South, and do Democrats face a McGovern-like debacle in 2004?
Oh, I don't think so at all about the debacle. I mean, the polls show that the country is split 50-50, and that's going to be reflected in the returns. I expect it's going to be a very close election no matter what happens, or at least it would seem. But it would seem at this point. So I don't think they're facing any such wipeout. As to giving up on the South has 153 electoral votes, and if you give up on it, you got to get 80% of the electoral votes elsewhere. Doesn't leave you much room for mistakes.
Continue the conversation on our website. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, Rush Limbaugh returns to the airwaves. This is On Point. Conservative icon Rush Limbaugh returned to the airwaves today, the radio waves, after a five-week stint in a drug rehab center. Limbaugh's voice was last heard on October 10th when he admitted on his nationally syndicated radio program that he was addicted to the painkiller OxyContin. In a 15-minute monologue opening his program today, Limbaugh reassured his listeners that he hadn't been turned into a, quote, linguine-spined liberal during his rehabilitation. And he quickly returned to attacking some of his favorite targets, like Senators Hillary Clinton and Edward Kennedy. Here's an excerpt from Rush Limbaugh's return to radio earlier today.
I have to admit that I am powerless over this addiction that I have. I used to think I could beat it with force of will. I used to think that I would be different, but I'm not. I'm just like anybody else who has an addiction. I'm powerless over it, and I have to continue to recognize that and make sure that the things that I've learned continue to be practiced. It's a challenge. It is, but it's exciting. You know, the things that I have discovered about myself, and if anybody who went through what I went through would discover about themselves, is just sort of like being reborn here at age 50. But I don't want anybody to get frightened about this now. This has no impact on what you have come to know, love, and respect here and expect, because I've not been phony here. I've not been artificial or any of that on the program. I was all that elsewhere. I was all that other places, but not here. And all of this will reveal itself. Now, I came out, and I've been cramming since Thursday. What's gone on here since I've been gone? So I see that Ted Kennedy called a bunch of highly respected minorities Neanderthals. The fact that Ted Kennedy's still in the Senate and hasn't been forced to resign means that nothing's changed. It's just a good thing Senator Kennedy didn't say it on ESPN, or he might have resigned. I have been cramming, and I'm looking. The Democrat Howard Dean's still running the show. The Democrats are still, you know, fantasizing about Hillary being the nominee. The Republicans still don't know how to get judges confirmed. Nothing's changed, folks, and it's time to do something about that. One more thing. This was fascinating for me over the weekend. I did read some of the so-called experts predicting what I will now be like and who I will now be. And what must have happened to me while I was gone? It is absolutely hilarious to read and listen to people who don't have the slightest idea what they're talking about, act expert, and all opinionated about it. What you know, what you think you don't know. But you will when I'm able to tell you all about it, and I hope that's going to be very, very soon.
Conservative commentator Rush Limbaugh returning to his nationally syndicated radio program today after spending the past 5 weeks in a drug rehab center. I'm Bob Oakes, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.